Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross, and I'm happy to be back in the studio
Welcome back, Tracy!
Thank you.
We should have put up a banner.
I was expecting it, so I don't really feel like I've been fully welcomed yet.
I'll get on that. Sorry. But Alan was such a good guest host for those 2 weeks.
He absolutely was, and people should definitely check out those episodes if they haven't already. But we've got some great stuff for this episode, too. We're really covering some important topics, like the fact that this year, more than 500,000 of the poorest Americans will be losing their food assistance.
And we're also going to be talking about the racial wealth gap and what we can do about it. So it's going to be a packed episode.
Yes, stay tuned.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. Over the course of 2016, more than 500,000 of the poorest Americans will lose $150 to $200 a month in food assistance. That's because many states will be returning to a rule that limits food assistance to just 3 months for people who can't find 20 hours of work a week or a job training program.
To discuss this, we're joined by Ed Bolin, Senior Policy Analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and Lisa Hamler-Fugit, Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks. Thanks so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Glad to be here.
Now, Ed, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, where you work, released a really great explainer video recently on what is at the heart of this problem. Can you help break it down for us so we can understand who's impacted and why this policy is even occurring?
Sure. It's a rule in the SNAP or food stamp program that says if you're a childless adult and you're considered able-bodied, you can only get food stamps for 3 months in a 3-year period unless you find yourself a job or find a job training program that qualifies.
These are the people that we call ABODs,
which sounds
like aliens, right?
Yes. We call them ABODs, able-bodied adults without dependents. But they're basically childless adults. Many of them, in fact, may have dependents, but they're not in their household when they're applying for SNAP or on the SNAP program. So who are these folks? It's a really diverse group of people. SNAP's one of the unique federal programs in that it's really eligible to almost all people who are poor enough to qualify. It's not limited to people with children. It's not limited to seniors. It's open to a wide variety of poor Americans. And so the folks that are on SNAP that fit this category include about 45% of them are women, slightly more are male. A third of them are over 40, so it's older Americans who are struggling to find jobs. Split is about 40% in urban areas, which means about 60% don't live in urban areas. Many of them live in rural areas where jobs are hard to find. So it's a really wide-ranging group of people. I think one of the most notable things about this group is that they are very, very poor. Even in SNAP, which is a low-income program, they're among the poorest population that participates in the program.
And yet at the same time, this is, for many of them, the only assistance they get. Is that correct? Because it's very broad, as you mentioned.
That is correct. If you look at other programs at the federal and state level that help low-income Americans, they're often targeted. So for instance, what we often call welfare or TANF is for families with children. So a childless adult's not typically gonna be eligible for that. If you look at other programs, they may be targeted for people on disability benefits, for example. And even if you look at things like Medicaid, you know, basic health assistance for people, you find that, especially in states that have not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, single childless adults are not eligible for the program. So this is really their safety net. It's almost one strand, not a whole bunch of strands. And so when there's this time limit in place for them, it can be really dire.
So what happens if a person is searching and searching for work? They really want nothing more than to work or to get job training that they need to be able to get ahead in the labor market, but they aren't able to find a job or they aren't able to find a job training slot. What happens to those folks under this rule?
Well, in most cases, they're out of luck. So the rule says you have to be working 20 hours a week or in job training for 20 hours a week. It doesn't say that a state has to help you find a job or has to create a job training program for you. Most states don't do that. It costs a lot of money to run job training programs. It's sometimes difficult to put them in certain areas where there might be people who need this assistance. So it really is on the individual to find that job or to find that job training program. And, you know, in a lot of places, there simply aren't those jobs available, especially for this really poor population that often has other barriers to work. It can be very difficult for them to find 20 hours or more of work.
And Lisa, I want to bring you into the conversation for a moment because we're talking specifically about food assistance. These workers or people in search of work who are amongst the poorest in our society are only really able to get food assistance. Why is this so significant? And I know a lot of people will say, well, isn't that where food banks come in and that sort of thing? How will this impact the food banks that you work with?
Well, we have not seen any changes in the demand on our statewide network of 12 food banks and 3,300 member charities. In fact, we've experienced a 40% increase just in the past 4 years. Now, that is also coinciding with the decision to reject the full statewide waiver of waiving the work requirement. What we see are our lines are growing ever longer every day with more people, those who work, those who are unemployed or underemployed, who are turning more frequently for critical food assistance because they're either time-limited from their food stamp benefits, such as the population we're discussing today. They're not low-income enough to qualify for food stamps, and those who are on food stamps have also experienced a reduction in their benefits. At the same time, we're seeing rapidly rising food costs. So, again, what we're seeing are increasing demand on our system as well as elevated rates of food insecurity, which the United States Department of Agriculture publishes every year. And in fact, Ohio now ranks sixth in the nation as having the highest rate of food insecurity. Hunger and food insecurity are merely a symptom of poverty.
And it might be useful to note that the time limit came back into effect in Ohio a couple of years ago, right? So right around that time of increased need that you were seeing. What we're concerned about at the national level is 23 states are going to join Ohio now in having this time limit in effect. And we fear the same kind of consequences in those places.
Well, and Lisa, as you sort of help us put a face on who's impacted here, we hear this term thrown around, ABODs, like, you know, we were saying at the top. It sounds very robotic. It barely even sounds like a human. But it also, it connotes this kind of dichotomy between the people who can work and the people who can't. And if you're in the ABOD camp, you're somebody who is able-bodied, then what's your deal? Why aren't you just working? You put out a report, your organization did, looking at the reasons that people who are affected by this policy might not be working that required 20 hours a week. What kinds of barriers to employment did you find people were facing?
Well, that's an excellent question. And I just want to say that, you know, there are a lot of folks that don't remember the 1996 welfare reform passage, which ended welfare as we know it and then turned over the program to the states. At the time of enactment, this particular provision, which time limits food stamps to certain populations, also known as ABODs, went into effect. It was then known as the most draconian, and then everybody kind of forgot about it because we had waivers, we've had ups and downs in our economy. States were fully exercising the waiver authority to waive the work requirement. What I do want to say is that over those 20 years, very little has been done for this population, including access to education and training programs. Most states just left this caseload alone and did not require them to do anything more than re-register on an annual basis. What we have found in our research is the term or the acronym ABOD is a complete misnomer for who this population is. In January of 2014, we entered a partnership with the Franklin County Department of Job and Family Services, who at that time identified that they had about 12,000 individuals that resided in Franklin County that would be subject to the time limit on food stamps statewide. It was estimated that there were about 134,000. Now, at the very same time, Ohio took the option to expand Medicaid that would serve this very population. So what began to happen is while people were losing their food stamps, they were also becoming eligible for Medicaid. And what I can tell you is that hungry people are not healthy people. And what we found, we wanted to know seven things about this population, including their work history, any barriers to participation that they had, previous encounters with the criminal justice system, their education level, their family dynamic, and quite honestly, I've worked in this field for nearly three decades, and what we found upon face-to-face assessments with this population is that 60% were males. One in five are at-risk young adults under the age of 25. We have youth who have been aging out of the foster care and the juvenile justice system. We found veterans, 34% of those that we have assessed are ex-offenders who are attempting to re-enter society and survive in a pretty harsh environment. And as anybody knows, ex-offenders have a very difficult time finding employment. We also found that they are not able-bodied nor able-minded. In fact, one in four of those that we assessed were currently under a doctor's care. Many were reporting that they were suffering from depression, anxiety, schizophrenia, bipolar, PTSD. In fact, one in three of the nearly 5,000 that we have assessed reported having a medical or a physical or mental limitation that limits their abilities to perform daily activities. That ran the gamut from diabetes, which is a diet-related disease, heart condition, injuries from crimes of violence. 30% have no high school diploma or GED, and even those that do have a high school diploma, many unfortunately are marginally or functionally illiterate. They are disengaged primarily from their communities at large. Only 37% even reported having a cell phone or an email address. They tend to be very transient because of a lack of income, sleeping on people's couches, episodes of homelessness. We also found that one in five did report that they were working, but they were their employment was in exchange for either food or housing. The other one that really troubles us is that 13% were caregivers for parents, relatives, or friends, and that is not an exemption category. 80%. We also looked at the most recent work history that they had. This is a population that tends to work in part-time, temporary, contingent, or day labor type employment. And while one out of three reported that they had worked in the past year, nearly 80% had never received unemployment compensation. Only about one in four had ever heard of the workforce systems in the state of Ohio, or what we call Ohio Means Jobs.
So, Lisa, I'm gonna jump in there just to ask you sort of a global question about this population. If we take away $150, at best $200 a month in nutrition assistance from these people, is that going to be the kick in the butt that they've been needing to just get out there and get a job? I say that with intended snark, right? I mean, because that's the claim on the other side, right?
Well, let me say this. This is probably one of the most truly penny-wise and pound-foolish public policies that I have ever experienced. This population wants to work, and let me be clear. We work with them every day, placing them with community-based organizations, attempting to help them gain some kind of skills that they can move into the workforce. But, you know, it's easier said than done. There are multiple barriers to participation. What, in fact, we will see is that those who suffer from mental or physical disabilities that are going untreated, they will continue to suffer those conditions. Their physical and mental health situations will certainly be compromised and at risk. It's pretty hard to find a job when you're not sure where you're going to lay your head.
Sure.
Lay your head tonight.
And I want to bring Ed back into the conversation for a moment, because I think that Lisa has raised some really important points about how this population is really misclassified. It really sounds like I hear able-bodied adult without children, or without dependents, rather, I'm thinking, you know, that sounds like, oh, maybe it's someone who's college educated and unemployed, but or it just sounds like someone who's ready to dive into the workforce. They just need to find that job. But it's clearly a population that's just as diverse and complicated as the rest of the population. What can be done to ensure that this is not the only safety net program that's available for them, one that's at threat right now in so many states?
Well, that's a big question. I think there's a couple ways to look at it. One is obviously Congress could fix or at least improve this law by, first of all, eliminating it. That'd be great. But they could also change it so that a state had to offer some real job training or some real assessment of the person's capacity before they make an assignment to job training, and that people kept their assistance if they showed they were willing to participate in the job training or look for the job. That fix would actually make this part of SNAP work a little more like it's often described, which is as a work requirement. I think there'd still be challenges with that. And then the question gets even bigger. What can be done for this population is to really look at how the safety net helps them. For this childless adult population, it really is possibly the only sort of slice of the American population that's taxed further into poverty. And that's because they're not eligible for some of the things that I think everybody finds to be a really effective anti-poverty program, which is the earned income tax credit or the child tax credit, which in its name sort of tips you off that it's not going to be eligible to this population. So, the larger sort of safety net already is kind of stacked against this group. And I think looking at that on the sort of global level would be an important way to say this is a diverse population that really does need help. It's not the person's crashing on their parents' couch and watching TV. They may be crashed on their parents' couch, but that's because they can't afford another place to stay, and that they're actually, in most cases, far, far more willing to work than to accept $170 in benefits for a couple of months. We've done go ahead.
Staying with that theme, right? I mean, I think one of the things that we've been hearing so much about from conservatives lately has been that they've got ideas when it comes to cutting poverty. And a lot of their ideas, of course, aren't especially new. They sound a lot like block grants and sending programs to states. Lisa, a lot of the things you were giving us the history lesson about that happened in the run-up to 1996 with what's often called welfare reform, but was the creation of the TANF block grant aid to families with minor kids who are poor and so forth. I guess I'm curious to hear both Ed and Lisa comment on whether this situation that we're facing with nutrition assistance has any bearing on the kinds of proposals that we're hearing from Paul Ryan and from other leading voices in the Republican Party right now about their approach to fighting poverty.
Well, I think it does, but I think it's often either ignored or not known. So, we know SNAP is actually a very effective anti-poverty program because if you count the benefits that SNAP provides as part of somebody's income, it actually raises a tremendous number of people either out of poverty or further up, closer to getting out of poverty. So it actually works in the very basic sense that I think everybody would agree if we all agreed on our terms. But I think sometimes that's a little bit glossed over.
Yeah, and I just want to say that what Congress could have done is, and I would encourage them to do, if they're serious about addressing poverty and using the programs that we have now, such as the SNAP Employment and Training Program, to provide 100% federal funding to allow states to develop strategies that are going to help address the education, training, and supportive services. That's really important for this population to prioritize all available services for this population that face the time limit. And in fact, even under the Workforce Investment Act that had made funds available to the states, that this population was never provided services. And in fact, why don't we have any data on this population? Because again, states solve the barriers and the challenges that many of these individuals faced, and really didn't dedicate those resources nor prioritize. I also want to say something that I think is really important for states that are facing this cutoff of nearly a million people. I have been struck in my observations in working with this population, not only at the elevated levels of both physical and mental disabilities, but the number of these adults who appear to be on the autism scale, making it very difficult to place them even with community-based organizations. Autism is a relatively recent diagnosis, and you know, autistic children grow up to be autistic adults, and they need just as many services as they had when they were children, but unfortunately without family supports that many of them are left to fend for themselves. So again, what states need to do is thoroughly assess, and Congress should expect that states are fully assessing this population and not randomly cutting their caseloads because somebody falls between the ages of 18 and 49 without dependents.
That's an excellent point, Lisa, and it's one of our big concerns when we look at these 23 states with the time limit coming back into effect. When you think about it, many states don't actually know who these people are because they haven't had to do any kind of assessment as to whether they're able-bodied or not. They've assessed their eligibility. Are you poor enough to qualify? How many people in your household, et cetera? But they haven't necessarily figured out if they are even eligible or able to work. So when the time limit comes back into effect, one of our fears, and we've seen this happen in a couple of states where it's already come back into effect, is that many more people are assumed to be subject to this 3-month time limit, and they get a notice and they say, we think you're an ABOD. You have to figure out what that means. You have to figure out what the rule is. You have to figure out whether you might be exempt from it or not, and then you can contact us. Well, if they in fact have a hard time reading, if they don't read English and the notice came in English, if they've moved their location and they never get the notice, they're going to get cut off after 3 months. And so I think that's a huge concern on sort of the micro level. What can states do when they're getting ready for the time limit to come back into effect is really to start saying, we need to know who these people are. And assessment is one of the critical pieces to that. I mean, I wish it was tied to, as Lisa was saying, if we assess you and determine that you are subject to this rule, we can then identify a job training program or what kind of services you need to get back on your feet. That's a step further down the line. Right now, I'm concerned that they're not even identifying the people subject to this rule.
And Lisa, And I want to say that that's exactly what we had requested when the decision was made to reject the waiver and reimpose the time limit. We asked the state to do a thorough, thoughtful, and planful process, extend the waiver for one more year, and to put this comprehensive assessment in tools so we could do it right the first time instead of widespread sanctioning folks off of the program. And in fact, the way and most of these folks reside in our metropolitan counties, and the way they were assessed is that they were called in mass assessments, in some cases 300 to 400 in a group. And if you had a difficult time understanding what was being communicated to you, it was lost. But again, I want to say that what we've been able to do in Franklin County, we have nearly 5,000 folks that we've assessed, have been a result because of local elected officials, our County Department of Job and Family Services, realizing that just by cutting food stamps off to this population with one hand and extending a Medicaid card to them with the other would not improve their overall health, well-being, or potential productivity towards employment.
And I'm glad that we're talking about what states can do, especially because we have you on the phone, Lisa, talking about some of the work that you've done with Franklin County Department of Job and Family Services. I'd love to just hear a bit more about, after you've done that assessment, how are you able to match people with the work experience program, given the various barriers that some of this population is facing? It would be wonderful to hear and some best practices that hopefully other counties or states can take on.
Well, and I've got to tell you, it has to be a partnership. It has to be a partnership with, if you're a state operated county administered program, you have to have champions within local government. You need the support of nonprofit, faith-based, and community-based organizations who are willing to open their doors to provide opportunities for what we call on-the-job training or work experience program training. And we have over 200 organizations that have stepped forward. We need to be able to provide wraparound and additional services to the individuals, ensure that they are motivated. We've got to get them to the site first. So that speaks to ensuring that they have the transportation allowance and transportation vouchers. Again, this population, they don't have cars. Some do live on bus lines, some don't. We see a lot of our clients walking to their site locations, but we need a good nurturing environment that is going to help motivate individuals when they're placed on the site, and that we're able to increase their capacity as well. We're connecting them in cases to GED, resume writing classes, job search classes. This population is really disconnected. They generally have very limited minute cell phones. They don't have access to the latest technology. They're not walking around with smartphones or have access to the internet. So we're doing a lot of online job searches. We bring employers in. We do big clinics every month where folks can come in and meet with potential employers. We also look at other opportunities for training in specialized areas that may provide them with some certification if they can pass entrance exams. We've also really developed a very strong relationship with the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, because often those who are reentering society fall into this category as well. So again, it takes a community effort, dedicated volunteers, as well as staff of both our public and private agencies to make it work. And I want to say the other thing that I think is very important, especially to Medicaid expansion states, that we need to ensure that Medicaid and SNAP benefits stay tied together, because the expenditures that we see on the Medicaid side, Medicaid expansion is a great thing, but if individuals are suffering from hunger and food insecurity, that Medicaid card isn't going to be a prescription for food. We have to ensure that they have access through normal channels to healthy, wholesome food, and that means that we've got to maintain their food stamp benefits.
Can I jump in for a second? So Lisa's organization is actually, I think, the national model for how to do this. It's just tremendous work what they've done in Franklin County, and it's in fact their diligent work that has given us some sense of who these folks are. But I just want to take one step back as far as what states can do, because, and we didn't talk, I don't think, at the very beginning, states have had the ability to waive this requirement if they have high unemployment. The idea being these are unemployed workers, and why subject them to a time limit if you've got really high unemployment? There's just not jobs there. So states during the recession largely did waive these areas, and the fact that the economy is improving is one reason that the time limits are coming back into effect. But the other reason is that states are choosing not to request the waivers, and that's probably for political reasons. And so one thing that people could do in states where that's the case is to start talking to the food banks and community organizations about this impact, and to say, hey, state, you should really waive this requirement. There are many things you can do with the SNAP Employment and Training Program and with other resources if you want to start to get these folks thinking about jobs and trying to get them some skills. You don't have to have a 3-month time limit that cuts off their food assistance. So there's about, I think, I was trying to tally them up, 15 to 20 states where the state is not waiving all the areas that have high unemployment, then I think that's would be a good first step for some states.
Yeah, they also, one of the provisions that was included, I believe, in welfare reform is that states earn what they call banked months of exemptions that could be used without any formal request or waiver to the federal government. They could access and utilize those banked months of exemptions. I mean, in Ohio, we've banked over 400,000 banked months of exemptions that could be used to extend benefits to this population while they're assessed. It's really important that states put together a thorough screening and assessment tool on this population. And again, many of these individuals probably should have been moved on and helped enrolled in Social Security disability, and that did not happen for many of them. So next steps for us not only is getting them connected to additional education and training where appropriate, but for those who have a disability that has existed for more than 12 months, we're assisting them and connecting them with resources to help them start the Social Security disability process. The other thing that is, don't kid yourself, these folks don't leave our communities. They stay within our communities. Their mental and physical health continues to decompose. It puts additional strain on the nonprofit and faith-based organizations. And more importantly, it takes money out of our local communities, SNAP benefits that are spent locally so people can stand in grocery store checkout lines instead of food pantry and soup kitchen lines.
And Ed Bolin, in the remaining 30 seconds that we have, where can our listeners find the video that Tracy mentioned at the top of the program that helps to explain what this ABOD situation is?
Well, it's on our website, so www.cbpp, for Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.org. We also have additional resources and can identify the states that could apply for more waivers than they are. And so I encourage people to check that out.
And Lisa, where can folks find the report that you were describing that puts a face on who's impacted in Ohio?
At our website, www.ohiofoodbanks.org, comprehensive report on able-bodied adults without dependents. It is the work experience program report. I would also encourage, and we developed the assessment tool, an online assessment tool. We're making it available to any group out there across the nation who would like to do as well the assessment that's necessary to make sure that we have the baseline and can develop comprehensive programs and plans for moving these people up into the economic mainstream where appropriate.
Lisa Hamler-Fugit, Executive Director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks, and Ed Bolin, Senior Policy Analyst at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thank you so much to you both for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis. People often talk about the retirement crisis, but there's an even more immediate crisis, people having no savings to fall back on at all. This has consequences not just for families struggling to meet their immediate needs, it has consequences for the next generation. And the situation is even more dire for communities of color. With me to discuss the racial wealth gap and financial fragility for low-income families across the board is Lisa Hamilton, Vice President at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which recently released a report called Investing in Tomorrow, Helping Families Build Savings and Assets. Also joining the conversation is Ezra Levin, the Associate Director of Government Affairs at the Corporation for Enterprise Development, better known as CFED, and home to the Campaign for Every Kid's Future, seeking to get children's savings accounts for 1.4 million kids by 2020. Thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio, both of you.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I'd like to start with you, Ezra, just to ground us in a little bit of kind of what do we know here, right? The retirement crisis has gotten a lot of ink in the news. Something that gets a lot less attention is a statistic that shocks me every time I hear it, which is that nearly half of Americans couldn't come up with even $2,000 in an emergency. And this is something that's often called financial fragility. What's going on there?
I love the term financial fragility. So we do a report at CFED called the Scorecard on an annual basis. And what we look at there is how are people doing, not just in terms of how much income they have and how much support they have to support their kids, but also how they're doing on this savings front. And as you pointed out, retirement savings is a big issue. There is a retirement savings crisis in the country, but it's just not retirement alone. What we care about at CFED is how can people get ahead? And when we look at that, we look at savings and investments. And I mean savings for the short term, that's emergency savings, kind of what you're talking about, but also investments in things like education for their kids or home ownership or entrepreneurship. And the statistic you pointed out is one of many pointing to the financial fragility of millions of Americans. This is poor Americans. It's also near poor Americans. It's also middle income Americans. Nearly half of Americans in the country are liquid asset poor. That's a technical term, but what it means is that essentially they don't have enough in accessible savings to fall back on should their car break down or should their number of hours be cut at their job. It's just an astonishing statistic that really speaks to what is a widespread concern for anybody that cares about economic opportunity or financial security in general.
Well, and to pick out one of the things that you said, a tagline that your organization often uses that I think sums up a lot of the research, which I would really love for you to summarize for us, mm-hmm. you know, succinctly to give us a grounding here, is that families need income to get by, but they need savings to get ahead. What does that mean?
That's right. So income's incredibly important. I think we're all on the same page there. You need some amount of regular income in order to pay for expenses, in order to keep your lights on and make it back by day to day. But if all you have is income and you have $0 in the bank, if you have zero assets, you don't have a home, you don't have a business, you don't have an investment in a college education, those dollars of income that you have to help you get by are not going to be adequate in the event of any kind of instability in your financial life. And what we know is that kind of financial instability is incredibly common and only getting more common. So we see a very large percentage of Americans who are low income and who are moderate income who experience sudden jolts in their budgets. They, like I said, they lose their job or maybe their car breaks down. They have expenses that they can't cover or that they suddenly have a loss of income. And so when we think about what it takes for Americans to get ahead, we think it starts with some amount of basic level of income, but then they also need this emergency savings and these investments that will pay off in the future so that they're not just making it by day to day and covering their bare necessity, bare baseline of expenses. They're also investing in the long term.
And Lisa Hamilton, I want to bring you in because we're talking about this in general terms. This is something that impacts families really across the board, but low-income families especially. But it isn't something that impacts low-income families equally. There is something called the racial wealth gap, and this is something that your organization, the Annie E. Casey Foundation, recently put out a report looking at. What did your report find?
Well, the information that Ezra just shared about the financial fragility of families is even more dire for families of color who are less likely to have savings or to have inherited assets like a home. And so when we look at the difference between the net worth between families of color and white families, we call that the racial wealth gap. And what we find is that on average, families of color have just a fraction of the savings and assets that white families have. What we have seen is that since the Great Recession, the net worth of white families has increased by 2%, while the assets of Latino families has dropped 15%. And for African American families, their net worth has fallen by a shocking 34%. And if you want to think about this in practical terms, what it means is that this decline in family assets has left black families with only 5 days of savings on average, compared to 1 month of savings for the average white family. So you can see how vulnerable families of color are if the unexpected happens. And that has a huge impact on their children, as was shared. Because the Annie E. Casey Foundation is focused on trying to help children have a brighter future, we consider what the impact is of this financial instability on the lives of children. And all of the research shows that children whose families are dealing with a downward spiral of debt and financial stress really have difficulty doing well in school. And that's certainly one of the stepping stones we need for them to be successful in the future. This is certainly a growing issue of importance. In just a few years, the majority of kids in this country are going to be children of color. So we urgently need to address this issue so that we can make sure that the next generation is on the path to opportunity.
Well, and you mentioned a lot of the reasons that this is important, right, from sort of the negative standpoint, that lack of savings is correlated with indicators of child well-being and their likelihood of success. The report actually goes into this in detail, how low levels of family assets are correlated with behavior problems during childhood and adolescence, also even teen pregnancy. But something else that your report highlights, which is maybe the more optimistic perspective, is that there's a lot that having more in savings can do to help kids have a better chance. What do we know about what savings means in terms of what chance it gives kids that they might not have if their family didn't have those savings?
What our report shows is that if families have the kind of savings and assets that help them weather the common events that happen in all of our lives, like a medical emergency or a car repair, it drastically reduces the amount of stress on those families and ensures that they have the resources to invest in the kinds of opportunities that do help children get ahead. The research also shows that the children in those families do better in school, they have higher self-esteem, they avoid behavioral problems, they are more likely to avoid teenage pregnancy. When families are able to set aside some savings, it really does create behavioral changes and changes in expectations for those children's futures. And it's shown that just by having some resources set aside for college, it increases by almost 16% the likelihood that those children are going to go to college. So it doesn't just have a benefit in terms of the stability of that family today, but absolutely positions that family and that child for a brighter future.
Well, and the report that you've put out, and also a lot of the work that you, Ezra, and your colleagues at CFED have done, has been around policy solutions that can change this situation, mm-hmm. both specifically for communities of color, but also more broadly for families who don't have enough in savings. And one of the policy solutions that both of your organizations have done a lot of work on is something called a child savings account, or a children's savings account, a CSA. It's often mm-hmm. called. Ezra, what are we talking about here? What's a CSA?
So children's savings accounts, the idea behind them has been here for a very long time. It actually goes back a couple hundred years. The same place that we source Social Security in Thomas Paine's Agrarian Justice, we actually sourced the first idea for some sort of children's savings account. Thomas Paine had an idea that when a child reaches adulthood, they would get a big lump sum to start out their life, invest in themselves. Maybe they start a business or buy a home, or in some way get off on the right foot. We didn't implement children's savings accounts at the founding of this country, but it's had a resurgence more recently. So in the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot more research into what these children's savings accounts can do. And the basic idea behind them is at birth, or when a child enters kindergarten, or at some point early on in life, you provide this child with the savings account, and it's a restricted account. This isn't an account like we're talking about for emergencies, for financial catastrophes that might hit. This is really an investment in their future. Traditionally, what these accounts have been limited for is higher education, home ownership, and entrepreneurship. And in some cases, it can be used for retirement as well. But the basic idea is that asset idea, that these savings that happen from birth or from when the kid enters kindergarten, and all the savings that is deposited and then the interest that's accrued from age 0 or 5 to 18 can then be used when the child graduates high school to make that kind of long-term investment and really expand the amount of wealth they have. Now, these programs are based in that early philosophy, but then they were built up as a result of a lot of research that was done. So we have dozens of scholarly works that look into what is the impact of providing these accounts, what impact is there on higher education success rates, both entrance to college and graduation rates. What we know, and it's a shocking statistic, is that a low or moderate income child with even less than $500 saved in one of these children's savings accounts for higher education is 3 times more likely to enter college and 4 times more likely to graduate. That is a crazy statistic. Think about that. Less than $500, and you're having an enormous impact on these college entrance and graduation rates. Needless to say, that's not paying for college. We know that you can't buy college education for $500. There is a different impact happening here. In part, it's the money. Of course, money helps. That's going to help folks enter and graduate college. But the other part, I think, is actually even more exciting, because it's about aspirations. And a researcher, Willie Elliott, at Kansas University, has done a lot of research on this idea of the college-bound identity. And it's basically the idea that some children grow up knowing that they're going to go to college. And that's great, because they build in those expectations from age 0 all the way up into high school. Many children, unfortunately, do not grow up with that expectation. They don't have that aspiration built into their normal daily lives. Children's savings accounts actually has the opportunity to change that, because you let kids know at birth or at kindergarten and through supportive programs, you're going to college. Here's a program. We've invested in you. This is your future. So I think that's some of the most exciting work that's been done, showing that the potential of these programs. And like I said, there's research, there's RCTs, randomized controlled trials, that also point to positive benefits. And there are a slew of programs across the country at the state and local level. And we can talk about that a little bit more in a second.
And Lisa Hamilton, I want to bring you back in, because part of what I found especially striking about this recent report released by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, looking specifically at the racial wealth gap and solutions to it, was you pointed to children's savings accounts as a tool for specifically reducing the racial wealth gap by half. Can you talk about how you arrived at such a striking number?
Yes. Well, as Ezra pointed out, the way that these savings accounts work is that they are seeded very early in a child's life, and families are able to contribute to them over time as they're able. Well, with such an early start in savings, families are able to benefit from the value of those investments increasing over time. And so it really does give families of color and white families an equal start in terms of getting on the path to savings. And when you do that, an analysis conducted by Brandeis University tells us that over time, depending on sort of a consistent level of funding or equal level of funding and participation rates, these accounts could reduce the racial wealth gap by anywhere from 20 to 80%, which is absolutely phenomenal. It's exciting to think that we have the opportunity as a country to really make it possible for all children to realize the benefits that Ezra talked about of having higher expectations set for them at birth, and then having even a modest amount of resources to help them fulfill those dreams.
Well, and you also highlight other policy solutions that we should be looking at if we want to address the racial wealth gap, but also if we want to address financial fragility for families across the board. And one of those solutions that you lift up in this report is the need to take away or really significantly raise savings caps in public assistance programs that keep families from even being allowed to save. Why is that something that you guys point to, and what is it that we can do about it?
Well, it's often the case that families who are receiving benefits are working hard every day to ensure their families can have a safe place to live and meet their monthly expenses. But it's extremely important that we help those families set aside whatever amount they can so that they can get on the path to a brighter financial future. The way that the public benefits programs work, and they're different by state, sometimes as little as $1,000 in savings could disqualify a family from public assistance. Now, while $1,000 certainly helps a family to meet an emergency, it certainly isn't enough to mean that they are self-sufficient and may not need that public assistance anymore. And so what we recommend is that those families who are receiving public benefits be allowed to save some modest amount, at least $12,000 in savings, which is the equivalent of 3 months' income for a low-income family of four, so that while they're working, they have the opportunity to become self-sufficient. We don't want those families to be trapped in a cycle of financial instability. And by setting arbitrary or artificial caps on what they can save, it really does keep them in a cycle that prevents them from moving forward. So we believe that by removing those limits, it could help families begin to create just some modest amount of savings that could position them for a more stable financial future. And in states that have done this, some have set particular dollar limits or removed those caps altogether. We haven't found that in any way increases the amount of individuals that are receiving public benefits. And in fact, in some instances, it's actually reduced that because those families are able to work their way to self-sufficiency. So we think it's a great way to help families move forward in their lives.
I just want to jump in here. I agree with basically everything Lisa just said. Asset limits are incredibly dumb policy. They make no sense. They're not good conservative policy. They're not super liberal policy. It makes absolutely no sense if you're reforming public benefit programs to tell folks who are receiving these public benefits to not have any savings. That's what these asset limits actually do. And this applies actually to everything we've already talked about. That is savings for financial security to combat this financial fragility issue. It's also savings for people's children. What sense does it make to set up a program where you're providing public benefits to, say, a single mother with a couple of kids, and if that single mother deposits $1,000 for her children into a college savings account, she gets cut off the benefits. You are penalizing her for saving for her children's future. Now, for that particular policy issue, there is actually a bipartisan bill in the House by Representatives Cartwright and Representative Ribble to eliminate all asset limits for public benefit programs when it comes to children's savings. We would like to see public benefit asset limits eliminated in general. You should be able to save for emergencies. You should be able to save for your kids, and you shouldn't have to fear for losing these public benefits that help you get by day to day. If we want to help folks actually get off public benefits and become self-sufficient, if that's your conservative goal, great. A great way to do that is to eliminate public benefit asset limits.
So in the remaining minute that we have, I just am curious if you guys each want to name one or two other policy solutions that we should have on our radar in addition to the ones that we've discussed today. And Lisa, I'll start with you.
Thanks. Well, in the Annie Casey Foundation's report, Investing for Tomorrow, we recommend two additional ideas to help families save for the future. The first is making permanent a type of account called MyRAs. many low-income workers don't have access to a workplace retirement plan. And so this special kind of account called MyRAs allow employees to invest in lower risk investments like savings bonds. And these accounts are portable and allow them to accumulate a certain level of savings for their retirement before they need to be rolled over to a traditional retirement account. We were talking about the racial wealth gap earlier, and again, an analysis by Brandeis shows that this policy could narrow the racial wealth gap by about 5% for Latinos and 7% for African Americans. So we think that it's certainly an important opportunity to consider. And then secondly, I'd just like to lift up strategies that can help low-income families become homeowners. And one of them is a federal program called the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. It operates now to help people who receive housing vouchers or who live in public housing save as their income increases. Typically, as their income increases, they'd have a corresponding increase in their rent. But this program allows those families to set aside some of their income in an account that they can save and use those assets to purchase a home in the future. And we think this certainly provides an opportunity for those families to have the kind of permanent, stable housing we'd want them to have in the future. Currently, the program's available, but it hasn't been made permanent, and only a fraction of the eligible residents are using it. So again, we hope that legislators would consider this as an important way to give low-income families access to homeownership.
And Ezra Levin, you'll have the last word.
Oh, great. Let me talk about two. One on the children's savings piece and the other on financial fragility. Now, we talked a little bit about the programs available that support this children's savings activity. There actually is a federal program that does this, and I hope you don't lose viewers because I'm going to cite tax code provisions.
I can guarantee you we have no viewers.
Oh, good.
Because this is radio.
Oh, wow. Why did I even dress up for this?
You look very nice.
Maybe we can include a picture. In any case, so the 529s are a federal tax program. It's tax-preferred savings for higher education. Now, 529s is a great idea. I like the idea of children's savings. Lisa and I are both here pitching this. The problem with them, though, is that high-income folks are basically the folks who are using this. What we know about 529s is Americans have over $250 billion saved in them, and that above-median-income households own 98.9% of all savings in these 529 accounts. 98.9. So when we're talking about expanding educational opportunity, when we're talking about reducing wealth inequality, that's not what these accounts are doing. And they cost the federal government, according to the Office of Management and Budget, nearly $2 billion in lost revenue. Now, for $2 billion a year, you know what you can do? You could provide $500 for every single one of the 4 million children who were born in the country every year. Now, I'm not for getting rid of 529s, but there are good proposals to make them more progressive. And I would like to see something like a proposal that Representative Ben Ray Lujan is looking at to reform some of our tax expenditures and provide support to low and moderate income students who actually really need it, rather than just actively expanding wealth inequality through a tax subsidy for the rich. The second one that I want to talk about gets this financial fragility issue. There is some great research by Professor Catherine Eden, Sarah Halpern Meekin, and others. It was in a book called It's Not Like I'm Poor. She followed up looking at it at $2 a day at a slightly different angle, looking at the financial lives of low-wage workers. And the It's Not Like I'm Poor book in particular looked at the importance of tax time and the importance of the EITC and the child tax credit and other provisions that help boost the refunds of low-wage workers. And what she sees is that these programs are not just income boosting, they're actually really economic mobility programs, because what they do is actually force low-wage workers to save over the course of the year, which you think is a bad idea, but in fact, they love it. The interviews that she did with about 130 Boston area low-wage workers getting their taxes done was they try to up their refund as much as possible so that at tax time, they can invest in fixing that car or invest in their child's education or pay off the debt that they needed to pay off. Now, the problem, though, is they're getting a huge amount of money at tax time, and that isn't ideal, because what we know about the lives of these low-wage workers is that they have very unstable income and unstable expenses. And so one of the things Kathy Eden and her co-authors found was that come 6 months after tax time, they didn't have emergency savings to survive these income losses and these surprise expenses. So we've been working with the authors of that book and a couple of senator offices to develop this rainy day EITC proposal. We're hoping to have it introduced soon, but essentially what it would do is give the option to some low-wage workers. It's not right for everybody. Some folks really need their tax refund at tax time, and they should have it. But for those who would like to build up a little bit of emergency savings for 6 months down the line, this proposal would allow them to do it.
Lisa Hamilton, Vice President at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and Ezra Levin, Associate Director of Government Affairs at CFED. Thank you so much to both of you for joining Talk Poverty Radio. And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @talkpovertyradio.